Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey Straight, No Chaser. Here we are. It is December the 13th, 2023. And we are in the last episode of 2023 here at Lenny Godfrey Straight, No Chaser. And I am Lenny Godfrey. So let me do a little housekeeping, and I will then introduce my guest to you. We are going to be talking about a lot of things this evening. It's been an interesting time lately, and I don't think that we can really ignore some of the things that we can talk about. But first, let me say that you are listening to blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. If you want to dial in, it is 1-516-453-6063. And there is about 100 and some episodes now that you can choose from if you want to catch up from when we came from, I guess it was 2000, eek, where are we, 21 that I started this. And they are archived by Blog Talk Radio. And thank goodness you can go and catch up. Sometimes I go back myself and listen to some of the interesting conversations that my guests have had with me. I'm just so honored that they do come in and share their thoughts. So with that, you know, I have one of my guests is here now, and we're going to try to reach the other guests who may be having some difficulty because sometimes Blog Talk Radio does not put all the guests through. But right now, I'm going to talk about Essence of Acting, Inc. The last time they were on, and I think it was November the 1st, that was the one I left out, and he let me know that as soon as he got on the air because I have been listening to that episode a little bit. But let me tell you a bit about my friend Franz Jones. He is an actor. He is a blog writer. He is a director who is currently living in Brooklyn. He has been recently named Marquee's Who's Who in America for 2022-2023 in the steps of his mother, Dr. Effie H. Jones, who was named in Who's Who's in American Education. He appeared on Broadway in the original production of Big River in the role of Bill. He's worked off-Broadway at a number of theaters, including Cafe La Mama, Soho Rep, The Lion Theater, and New Media Rep. He has had the opportunity to play the title role in Othello at New Harmony Theater, and he has played in Waiting in Godot at the New Art Theater, and I can go on and on in a number of classical works. He has participated in The Lion's Tale, The Comedy of Errors, Hamlet, Romeo and Juliet, and more. He attended Texas Christian University, received his Master of Fine Arts from the University of Delaware, and he was also a recipient of the Diana Sand Scholarship from the Circle in the Square Theater. Ladies and gentlemen and everyone, here is Franz Jones. Franz Jones, please say hello to the guest. and the audience.
Good evening. Good evening. How are you, Ms. Lee? Ms. Lee Godfrey.
Yeah, you know what? I'm okay. I'm a little worried. My other guest is Diane Wilson, and I'm a little worried for Diane because the last time we called, she was the first one on, and I don't know if she's having any difficulty. So we're going to try to call her again and see if we get her. But other than that, I look forward to speaking about the arts in education, but also just speaking about the arts in general. In the last couple of weeks, and we have weeks to go before the end of 2023, we have lost some
Not that many weeks. We've only got two. Three weeks
but
now.
It's enough time. It's enough time.
Yeah.
We've lost some really immensely talented people. Today, I will say that it is the birthday, though, the 80th birthday, Maurice Hines Jr. And I was so proud to be able to not call him this time because they did a wonderful tribute call, but to be able to post that I have known this man and the impact that he had on my life was it's everlasting. And then the passing of so many wonderful artists that we have known over the years and grew up with, you know, and how that impacts us in the arts so much, the changing of the arts and everything like that. It's unfortunate because I think sometimes one thinks that your involvement in the arts is based on some of the people that you have watched over the years. And when these people pass away, whether they're younger or older, it does impact you, what your responsibility, what have they left you to do, and how diligent are you about doing it. And I think that's what I'm thinking about more than anything else. And I do think about the impact that we have, that education has on the arts. I worry that our students don't know enough about the contributors of the arts in our culture. I wish they knew more. I wish that the current people who are there, who are wonderfully talented, were not the only people that they knew, that they had a desire to be more curious about what came before. And that's my worry because, quite frankly, that's what sustains us, what comes before, because what comes before will influence what comes after. What are your thoughts on that, Ron?
I absolutely agree with you. First of all, I want to take a step back. I know that Maurice is very special to you because the two of you were in UB together. I met Maurice about the same time that you were in UB and have been friends with him pretty much ever since. So I'd like to also add my voice to wish him a very happy birthday. Maurice always teased me and called me the working diva because I always had jobs. I always managed to find somewhere to work, be it in or out of the arts. I kept myself busy. I never liked to lay fallow, so to speak. So I miss seeing him, but I want to wish him a very happy birthday. Like you, yes, I think that there's been a lot missing in the arts lately, even more than before. It's interesting that we're talking about this again because I watched the film earlier tonight called 88, and it was about the election of a black president. This is post Barack Obama, and a young black man is working on his campaign and uncovers some nefarious dealings going on to get this guy elected. I don't want to tell the entire story because I'd like people to go out and watch it if they can. It's called 88. An interesting film, but one of the things they talked about in the film was something that you and I have spoken on many times, and that's whenever things are cut, whenever things are taken out of curriculums for students, it's always the arts that go first. And they talked about this in this film as well. And it always has been, and it continues to be, and it's really daunting that we still live in a world where the arts, which is something that can really help young people to formulate their minds so that they can think critically, is being taken away from them. That's the first thing that goes, because that's, it makes it easier for people to kind of be made to step in line with another agenda, because they're not, then they're not encouraged to think for themselves. They aren't encouraged to see the world in color. They're encouraged to see it only in black and white. And I've seen that a lot lately. You know, I've seen, I live near a school, and I listen to the way that the kids speak to one another when they come out at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The language is horrifying, one. And two, it's the same thing over and over again. I can walk by 20 kids, and there's no variety in what they're saying. I mean, I can remember when I was in school, I mean, there were kids on one side that might have been involved in one thing. There were kids over here that were involved in something else. Some kids that were involved in sports might be talking about sports. Kids that were involved in music might be talking about music. Kids that were involved in academic pursuits would be talking about their classes after, but there were different conversations going on. Now it doesn't seem to be that way. You don't seem to have that. It seems to be only one conversation, one way of speaking. And indeed, if a child does speak outside of it, he is ostracized by the general group. And that is unfortunate.
You know, it bothers me because it does not encourage one to not be a loner, but to break away and have their own opinion. I think that the strength of a lot of the organizations, as well as the school environment, in, as well as the theater environment, it encourages the group participation. And there's nothing wrong with being a team player. But I think you have to be a team player in order to be a leader. But it doesn't encourage that next step. It encourages that you should always agree with what is agreed upon by the group. Somehow that should be your. And I'm finding that more and more in what I am confronting as a person in the industry when I want more. I want something different. You know, I expect something different. I don't, you know, I don't settle very well when I go to the theater and I realize that people are under rehearsed or, you know, they have not concentrated. Now, you have taught theater at Cornell. Yes, right?
Yes, I did. I did for a year, yes.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
What was your experience like with students there? You know, when you get to that level of education, you do, you are then to a point where you have shown that this is something that you really want to do, that this is your vocation, that you did you feel that that was being shown by those students there? And did you feel that the faculty there, that the administration there was helpful in pushing that through? There's so much now, there's so much controversy on faculty and the leadership in universities and what their priorities are. Did you feel that that you were supported then?
Not as much as I would have liked to have been. It was interesting because I did teach theater students, but also non-theater students, students that took theater as an elective. It was interesting because sometimes the students that took it as an elective had more enthusiasm than some of the theater students themselves. It was interesting because I think I might have said in the last show that we did about this, we were given a syllabus from which we were to teach. And I found that syllabus, well, the syllabus for me was outdated. They wanted us to teach plays that weren't actually, not so much performed, but aren't even being studied and weren't necessarily representative of theater from the 20th century in a diverse sort of way. And mm-hmm. I tried, as did some of my colleagues, some of us, we wanted to see if we couldn't do some other things and teach some other plays in the courses that we had. And we were mm-hmm. told no. We were strictly told, you teach this and that's it. You know, it was daunting because there's so many other works that never get any attention. And I was trying to find ways to bring them in, to bring in some pieces that nobody ever really reads or pieces that are more current that the students might find they can identify. But no, that wasn't the case. They were pretty strict about what they wanted and how they wanted it done.
One question. When you interviewed for this position, did that ever come up about how the parameters of what they wanted to be taught, or was that not something, did you just think, you know, this is a syllabus, but I figure that this is a university or school or institution, whatever, wherever you are, that has more flexibility. Did that come to play for you?
Well, it's interesting because when I came to them, I was hired. I had to go through an audition process and bring my materials in to be a guest artist. So the teaching part was secondary in that respect. I was there not just to teach, but to appear in plays with the students in certain roles. I was assigned 3 or 4 roles that I was to play. When I got the syllabus, I wasn't told initially that this was the only thing. I thought that it was an example. It was kind of a ground
template.
From which, yeah, a template is the best way to say
mm-hmm.
it. But somewhere
mm-hmm.
from whence you can then spring to work on other pieces or to do other things, to make other choices. And once I was there, I found out that that was not the case. So, yeah, I was under the impression that, oh, well, you know, one I always mentioned is Waiting for Lefty, which was considered talking about the group theater. And I remember thinking at the time, I said, well, no one really does Waiting for Lefty. I said, my entire life, I've never seen a production of it. I don't even remember reading it when I was in school. I thought that perhaps we might do Golden Boy or another play from the group theater days, but they wanted Waiting for Lefty for whatever reason, and they said, no, you will do that one. We were given Fences from August Wilson, and I
mm-hmm.
had wanted to take a look at some other African-American playwrights, and I was told, no, you will teach Fences. I think I told you, I ended up putting it in scene study class, but I had 2 white kids play Troy and his wife, which they weren't very happy about. But
mm-hmm.
I wanted to show that these plays are universal. That's what we're told.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I at the time that I did it, and it was only in a classroom situation. It wasn't a production. But I wanted the students to have an understanding of who these 2 people were. So I had a young lady who was from Brooklyn and a young man who was from the Bronx. And I had them play those roles, and they said, use your accents. I took out references specifically to color, but there were things in there that were universal for them to play.
Mm-hmm.
It was a scene where mm-hmm. she confronts him about his extramarital relationship. And
mm-hmm.
it worked. But they were not very happy. I think I told you also previously about a lab production we did of Romeo and Juliet where we had a dark-skinned black girl play Juliet. And she had short afro, and they weren't very happy about her either.
It's just interesting.
Yeah.
You know, prototypes that people
yeah.
have about who should play what. And also limiting the writing of people of certain cultures to only be played by those cultures. Now, I know that there are not a lot of jobs for us.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, we should have the opportunity. Well, I think it just opens up another door for us to say, let's try that, and then they should try giving us an opportunity at their culture, as we, you know, as we are bombarded with a culture from the time we were children in television, a culture
right.
that we have no relevance for. I mean, because we don't have that the privilege or the advantages of a culture that we see on television all the time. That is not afforded us.
Right.
But we are forced
right.
to understand it. But no one is forced to understand and know ours. They,
yeah.
they make some assumptions, you know. And there are a few people mm-hmm. who do. Now, I'm going to,
mm-hmm.
we're almost at the half hour mark.
Are you
yes.
serious?
So I'm going to try this number again just to make sure
okay.
that she's not trying to get in, because I've had people try for a very long time to get in to the show, put on hold by blocking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it's just not happening for her at this point. See, this is the number. So.
Yeah, it hasn't gone to voicemail, which if she was just not answering, that would happen.
Be occupied with something.
Somewhere else. She's in the ether.
Yeah, yeah. Stop ringing. Hello?
Mm-hmm.
I know it says it's dialing. It you know, don't know. There could be something wrong with it also, because I've talked to her and she was having problems with it. So I'm going to cancel that and not worry about that. But, see, I told you how quickly it goes. You didn't think so, though, did you?
Yeah, no, I thought we were still in the first 2 minutes.
You know, I have a great concern. I always had a great concern about how the education system viewed the arts and what our purpose was in the arts. I mean, when you go into the education system, my biggest peeve is the young students that are about to graduate and they're studying and the inability for the institutions to give them the opportunity to work, you know, with a professional company. I think I learned more in one summer up at the O'Neill than I learned a year and a half in class because of what you're exposed to people who do it for a living. And you're exposed to their confidence, their lack of confidence, their insecurities, their enthusiasm, the stories that they tell, their survival rate. Then comes the talent and watching them work from day to day to day. I used to sit up in the rafters because one of the things that I did while I was a student actor there, I did appear in a production at the O'Neill, but I was on lights and I loved it. I loved the sea wrench and climbing up like a little monkey almost. It was fabulous to sit up there. And once I had created the atmosphere, I could sit and watch these masters work because a lot of them looked like me and they didn't have a lot of opportunity. But because of Lloyd, there was a contingency of Black actors that were asked to come up again and again because they were so good at being able to apply their artistry to the script so that the playwright could see if it worked. And they put that in front of themselves. That is something you will never learn in a classroom.
No.
You will never learn in a classroom. And so
by
the time, you know, my production came midway this summer. So I knew a lot of the things that would allow me to appear to approach the level of professionalism that these people had. I don't understand. And there was a phrase that Diane said the last time we met, and she said, wasted opportunity. I can't tell you how I feel that it is a wasted opportunity when students are not allowed to apprentice, to ghost, to shadow professionals before they have finished their education so that they can see, they can work harder so that they can see what they have to do. These people are doing this for a living. You may be the best in high school. You may be the best in college. But it's just like everything. When you go, you're the best in middle school. But when you go to high school, you're a freshman. You got to start all over again.
Right.
So you become then the best in high school. Then you got to go to college. You go there, you're a freshman. So you then have to become the best in college. You graduate college. And you're out here with people who've been out here for 15, 20, 25, 35, 45, 50 years. You are not even a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have the opportunity to sit on the floor and listen to the stories. And these students don't get that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And they come out, some of them are good, but you know, we in EOA have many students who come through, but we find that we spend the first part of our rehearsals teaching them the discipline and the protocol of theater. Because while they're in the camp classroom, they may be learning something, but they're not learning that. Oh.
No, they don't. You don't have a lot of companies. You don't have a lot of companies nowadays that have apprentices any longer. It's not like it was. It's really interesting that we're talking about some of this because I never really apprenticed in a company. I kind of went from school into a professional environment almost immediately. I mean, Washington, where I grew up, didn't have a lot of theatrical opportunities at the time that I was growing up. Some of them came later after I was long gone. What was there, I took advantage of almost immediately. I used to go and look in the newspaper, and I auditioned for companies and productions that were done in the community theater and that sort of thing. So I got to work with older performers, some of whom acting, directing, that wasn't their main job. They had day jobs or something like that, but they might have been former performers who were now retired or had gone back to live in the area. So I worked with a lot of them, and that's where I kind of started working, so that by the time I got to college, I had already kind of worked with a number of theatrical units and been around older people and watched them work and learned how to do makeup and watched how sets were built and that sort of thing. So for me, it was a little different. I never had that real opportunity. Okay. Yeah, I never really had that opportunity to be an apprentice per se. You know, and then for me, I had to, of course, I had to go to school during the day. So everything I did was at night, and then at night, whenever the show was over, rehearsal was over, I had to run home to be home to get up the next day to go to school. My parents were very intent that education was number one. You know, after you get your education, your life is yours, but while you are under my roof, this is what you are going to do. So, so by the time I was in college and it started to, I went out and auditioned for, short story. I wanted to go to NYU, get up to school. And I wanted to apply to NYU, and I was put in the position by both my parents and said no. My mother said to me no, because if you go to NYU, you won't go to school. You go and audition for shows and try to get on Broadway. She was right. Nevertheless.
Yeah.
I mean, that was I wanted to be in New York.
I shiver to think how many students registered for classes down there and wind up in off-Broadway and Broadway productions because, you know, in the city, they had stage
business
and papers and everything else, and you didn't finish until maybe later.
No.
But yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not until later. No, I did that when I got the scholarship to Circle in the Square. I was there for a year. I didn't actually finish out that first year because I got a job. I was talking about this recently, too, with one of my colleagues I was working with. One of the directors, Nico Zakharopoulos, who was a well-known director, Broadway, off-Broadway. He was the head of the theater in Williamstown in Massachusetts. He worked there every summer. But Nikos would always tell us, you are not ready to act professionally. You must study first. When I got a job and I came to him, I said, well, Nikos, I'm going to be leaving soon because I got into a tour. He turned to the class and said, this is what you should be doing. Franz has gotten a job because he is trying to work as an actor. You should be practicing your craft. I never laughed so hard in my life. He went from one to another. But after the tour was over, I went back to him. I went and studied with him again because I liked what he had to say. And over the years, I would, time to time, even while working, go and take class and try to brush up on my skills and make sure that I always had a relationship with work in that respect. But I wish I might have been able to have been in an apprentice somewhere and maybe start from the beginning and kind of work that way. It would have been a great gift. And it's unfortunate that gift is no longer being given by a lot of companies.
No, it's not. But ironically, here's the other part of it. Yes, I got that opportunity, but when I wanted to leave to go and do a professional job my last semester, right before graduation at my school, if you had a certain point average, you didn't have to take any finals. So I didn't have to take any finals my last. And so, I was just going to class. So I thought I auditioned for something and got the role of the understudy for it. I mean, I'm a college student, so, you know. And I was overjoyed. I thought, and my advisor said, no.
Really?
You will get your degree. You will walk down that aisle, and then there will be another show for you to do when you're finished. And I went, but this is what I'm studying. They said there will always be a show. And, of course, they were right. I mean, you know, I stayed, and toward the end of the semester, I auditioned for something, and when the semester was over and graduation was over, I had a job to go to. I was working in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no formula, but for me, there is I think, something missing when we take that opportunity away from young people and they don't get a chance to see just a peek of what they're in for. Because It separates the men from the boys, the girls
absolutely
from the women.
Absolutely.
All of that, you realize, you know, this is not for me. I'm not going to deal with that. Oh, this is, I can't wait. Okay, I have to do this, and I need to take this class, and I need to do that, and I need to do this, and I need to get a job so I can get a job. You know, I need to have a job so
that's
I can
right
get a job, and all of those things.
Right.
And I see young people come in, and they're, you know, there are groups of people who come in, and if they go to certain schools, they have certain privileges and advantages, and that's great. But then those privileges are not extended to. And
this is true.
There needs to be an equal plane, I think, for it. But, you know, I'm not one to speak. I have been very blessed within my category, you know, my environment and my category of work. That it has been a wonderful ride, let's put it, a wonderful ride. And a ride that I'm still developing, because I still, even when I'm doing this, I go, how did I start this? 110 episodes later, what am I, you know?
Starting your own theater company.
Yes. Spoke to.
Should I tell the story of how I got involved in that one?
Oh yes, well, we'll tell it. But let me. I just spoke yesterday to the magnificent, I call her Melba Tolliver, who called me, and don't know, Mel, but she was the first anchor, black anchor, in network television.
Yes.
And she was for a while then NBC, and, you know. And we've become, she's become a guidance for me. And, you know, one of the things that she, and always I talk to her, she's always moving forward and always curious. She'll say to me, well, Lenny, why do you think that is? And I go, I don't know. Now you got me thinking. She always makes me think. She's a wonderful journalist, if you want. You know, she is from the old school of journalism and believes that a question should be a question and not a leading question. Ask the root of your question should have some basis, and you should ask, for example, how are you feeling today? Instead of, how does it feel to be a little restless today? Which is an indication that you already told your person that they are in a state that they have to
be. You're suggesting.
Now, you must give your interviewee the opportunity to establish their own answers. She's from that school. And I'm still in school, which is amazing. I'm still in school when I talk to her about this because she's come on. She's been here now and started my first year, and then she started, came my second year, she started for me. And hopefully maybe she will come again, you know, the third year. An inspiration.
Yeah, well, it's called, one of the things that, you know, I do is I work as what's called a standardized patient. They use actors to help medical personnel learn their craft, doctors, nurses, and even medical support staff. And I've done things like play the patient of the week, different diseases and maladies. Also, and I've also played doctors, but one of the things that, and it's funny that you're mentioning this, because one of the things that we work with students to do is ask what's called open-ended questions. And that's basically what Melba has always done. You ask a question, say, what brings you in today, Mr. Johnson? I'm having pain in my chest. Can you tell me more about that? Well, I'm having pain in my chest right here in the center because it's hard for me to breathe. And when it's hard for you to breathe, can you speak more about, so you're opening the door to allow the person who's being interviewed to expound on whatever it is you might like to have them talk about.
Exactly. You know, I have people who have, you know, come and asked me about doing a podcast. And I am very honored. I'm flattered by that. That means that it looks like it's something that people think that they can do, which means that the work looks easy, even though no work is easy. You know, if you don't, those of us who are in business, you get people who say on the street, "I saw you in this play. I've been singing all my life. I can do that." And I go, "Okay, the discipline." When you make it look easy. But one of the things that I think that I tell them is that this, like anything else in the arts, do because it is important to you. Like when you write about something, write about what you know. If you are a person who is physical and you are gifted with physicality, you know, then it is somehow you're going to be an athlete or dancer, a choreographer who, you know, has that flexibility but also has a vision. Those are the things that you should pursue, but that doesn't mean that's the only thing that you're going to do. You then like the question, it leads you to the doors open up and it leads you to something else. When you are open to receive it. Now, I'm going to say now that we are almost 15 minutes away from not being finished with this. The board is there. they're participants on the board. If you want to ask a question about all these things that we're talking about, and it's about education, but it's about 2023. It's about the peaks and the valleys and those who we've lost and those who we are losing. And if you have a comment to say about it, then just press the button one, and I will see it, and I will put you on the air. So I don't want too much time to go because we have less than 20 minutes, really less than 15 because,
When you're speaking about people that have gone, the shock for me this morning was to find out that Andre Brower had passed. I was shocked. Because I didn't watch television or anything last night, so I hadn't heard it. And he's a younger guy. I mean, just...
He is one of those, when he hit the scene, I said, this man is a monster. He was anything he touched, you wanted to see him in. He and Jeffrey Wright are that. That's what that is.
He and Jeffrey Wright, absolutely.
He was a monster. Above monster.
Yeah.
You know, my heart sank. It's been a week of sinking my heart many reasons.
Yeah.
And he's one, I just thought I'd watch him get better and better. As he got older,
if there was a thing.
But he leaves such a wonderful legacy, and he's so, to me, just, when his name would come up, I can go, okay, now what kind of brilliance am I going to see now? Because you knew it was never what you expected. And it made you reach for more. You know, it made you reach for more. You know, it's.
I'm going to do something that I don't think has ever been done on your show. I'm going to sit in the other chair for a moment, if I may. I really would like for you to share with the audience your experience of working with Norman Lear, please. You've spoken to me about it at length personally. But, I saw you on the show many times, was always so proud to see your work. But I really would like for you to share with the audience what you got and how special it was to be in the presence of that man.
Well, you know, I have to tell you the twofold parts of it because I met him twice. Norman, as he liked it, took, first of all, people laugh when I, but it took me 2 weeks to call him Norman. I made him so angry. He said, if you call me Mr. Lear one more time, that is my father. That is not me. My name is Norman. That's where he had to go. I just couldn't get it out of my mouth right. So I would say, excuse me, I wouldn't call him anything. I wouldn't call him anything. Oh, well. I have a question. Yes, Lenny. And I wouldn't call him anything. And he caught up that. He said, so I don't have a name now, right, Lenny? when you are in the presence of people who have done extraordinary things, I've been in the presence of several people who are like that. I talked about Melba. I find her to be there. I talked about Lloyd. I find him to be there. I talked about Yumi Blake, you know, a man who lived to be 100, another man who lived to be 101, Norman Lear. When you are in extraordinary company like that, you have to sit and pause. For me, I had to sit and pause and go, okay, what does this experience mean in my life? Because you know people belong to everybody. They don't just belong to you. They may make you feel that you're the only person in the room, that they're the only person that you're that special person. But there are many people who was that special person. What was it like? Mm-hmm. It was a life of masterclassing in not only production, values because he had a team. So you didn't see him working per se. You saw the results of his mind working. So his team was exquisite, and they had worked with him for many decades. And you saw that working, and that inspired me to see, to know there's a method. There's not a formula, but there's a method that one makes for successful work. Now, successful work doesn't mean commercial successful. It means getting the message across. Watching that work inspired me years later to do EOA, of course, but years later when I had, I think, the maturity to step back and want to open it up for other people, because that's what Norman did. Norman saw talent. If you listen to the interviews of Sherman Hemsley, you know, I think that he saw him in Pearlie or something. And Sherman didn't have a...
Yeah, I believe it was Pearlie.
Yeah, he didn't have an agent. So they were looking for him for the Jeffersons, but they didn't know how to find him because he was post office.
Yeah, no, when he was doing Pearlie, he kept his job at the post office. He would go home every night to Philadelphia and go to work in the morning. Yeah.
Exactly, and work. And he, when they were looking for that character, because that character was played by another actor in All in the Family for a while. When they were looking for the coupling of that neighbor, he called the office. He called the office and said, I think I'd like to be able to have an opportunity to audition. I don't have an agent, but, and they said, we've been looking for you. And it's the same exact thing. I had been in New York. I'd been doing a wonderful show called 39 with all the music and dedication to music and theater and movies of 1939. And he had been canvassing the country looking for this woman. I had, before all of this, I had been approached by Reuben Cannon. And he said, I think something for you. It's a great part. It's a supporting part. And Norman is looking for somebody. I think that you would be good. I want to put you on tape. And I said, okay, that'd be great. So I did it. And I thought, you know, this is an opportunity. I really loved the whole idea, like Jackie Harry had in 227, how she built up that character and how wonderful it was in her career and winning an Emmy. So you think, well, this been done, and this is something that I can come and contribute, but I'm not carrying anything. And there was another actress who was named as the lead because he was looking at, and I will say her name, Isabel Sanford, they were looking at Miss Sanford. I guess a lot of different things happened over the time, and then I did the tape, went away, and went to work in the theater. Time to go back to L.A. I was living in L.A. part of the year then. And my agent said, oh, they're looking for you. Norman Lee is looking for you. And I went, oh, well, you know where I was. I was in New York. But I couldn't get out because he was in New York at tech time. And you can't get out at tech time.
No,
he said, well, he wanted to know when you're coming back. He saw the tape. And I went, oh, great. I love this. I love the dialogue there. I love it. And they went, oh, no, not for that part. I went, oh, really? Oh, it's for the lead. I said, the lead? I said, oh, no. I mean, I never accepted it. I never accepted that whole concept. I said, well, of course I'm going. I mean, it's Norman Lear. But he is not right. I know. He's going to find somebody. I can just, you know, I'm a coach, and I'm going to convince him that I could be this other thing. Well, there I sit by myself. This is at the end of his casting now, so I'm the only one that he hadn't seen, I guess, coming down the hall with this white hat, and there are four or five people behind him, an entourage. And it's so funny. I can see it so vividly. And I'm sitting there in my best supporting role regalia, being a diva, you know, thinking, okay, I'm going to be sensual. and he looks at me and he says something to the line producer who was it Patricia Pete, I think, Patricia Pete, who I didn't know at the time. And she kind of chuckled a little bit. And he went in the room, bowed his head and went in the room. And I went, okay, now what was that about? I go in the room and we start, you know, I started doing, and he stopped me and he said, well, what do you think about this woman is religious? I said, well, what religion? He said, what? I said, what religion? I said, is she a Baptist? Is she a Methodist? Is she a Pentecostal? What religion? And he went, uh-oh. You know, because, I mean, I'm my mother now. I said, okay, so you really want me to be this woman? Then we're talking about my mother now. And he said, well, what would she be? I said, oh, she'd be Pentecostal because that's my mother. She'd be Pentecostal. I know that. And that conversation, we never went back to the script. Never went back to the script. No. That conversation led to me coming back and meeting Mr. Amos. And I had a brief encounter with him on the Erie Lackawanna train in New Jersey when I lived in New Jersey. He got on before I did, in the township I lived in. And he was there, and I knew who he was. I bowed my head, and I kept on going. I don't bother people of that celebrity status. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a life, and they want to be bothered. Right. They don't want to be bothered. He was behind me, so I had to go past. He got up and left when we got to the last stop, and I left behind him. And I saw in his suit, in his seat, was his wallet. And I thought, Lord, this man, wallet in the seat. No, you are not going to be running behind this man saying, hey, man, I got your wallet. I said, no. So I found the conductor, and I said, it belongs to that man over there. I said, he left it in the seat. I went on about my day. So when I met him, we had a great time. He said, Norman said, is there anything else you want to say? I said, well, I think I should tell Mr. Amos that, you know, I'm the reason why you found your wallet on the Erie Lackawanna train. And he looked at me. He said, that was you? I said, yeah, I gave it to the conductor. And he said, yeah, and the conductor said a woman. He said, that was you? I said, that was me. Years earlier.
Wow.
And we didn't work anymore. And the next thing I knew, I was getting ready to take my husband to the airport. We were going out to dinner. I got a phone call. That's when the cell phones were as big as your pocketbook, almost.
Yeah.
And from my agent that said, Mr. Lear has signed you to his organization and wants you to be the lead. I didn't even read a lot of text at all. It was all circumstantial.
Wow.
So I say that story.
Wow.
To say that it was magic. It was like being in a fairyland for 2-3 years. That's what it was like.
Wow.
I will never, ever touch it with anybody else. He treated me like I was a princess. He wanted that to be something like it was for Sherman for me, but it didn't turn out. And he blamed himself a little bit because, you know, the town sometimes turns against you, and a lot of the tide wasn't in our favor. But
well, there was also a strike, though, wasn't there?
Yes,
it was a strike.
Well, it was before that. But it wasn't. It didn't affect us. It didn't affect us because we did a pilot, then we did another pilot, and it was months, and then we went back and we started. Oh, I was in all of that for a couple of years, really. For the small amount of time that he worked in his arena and in his aura for about 2-3 years. And that's amazing,
that's
having
incredible.
That
room with,
that he would include me in that. So I can't tell you what it was. It was just magical.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
and with that, we're almost, the hour is almost up. I took a lot of time.
No, I think that's the reason why I had to change chairs with you, because I think that, and I need to just say, I think it's very important that your audience and me being one of them hear that. because we're talking about art, we're also talking about how times have changed and how we've lost some people. And this man was very important to our generation, at least, in terms of film and television, most especially television. He created television that changed most of our lives in some way or another. And mm-hmm. the fact that you had this great opportunity to work with him is very important for your audience to hear. I think that this is the gravy. This is something that this is worthwhile us sitting here and having conversation. Quite frankly, you know, this is wonderful.
I don't tell it often. You know, it is, you know, something that I treasure, and I never wanted to commercialize my relationship with him. It was just always there. He and family were just precious to me, and they're still uh-huh. very precious. But with that, I think we're down to the point where I have got to say to my audience that this is about it for 2023, everyone. We're going to take a break. We will resume mid-January. I would say that January the 10th or the 17th, you know, I will monitor to make sure everyone is having a wonderful holiday season and the blessings that you have and the blessings that you have given me for listening to it. And I don't divulge a lot about myself. I don't, you know, I'm sensitive like that because sometimes people misinterpret it. So, in France, and I hope I didn't bore everybody.
Well, I think it was not. I mean, I think it was well worthwhile. I'm so glad that I was able to hear that because that is an amazing, amazing story. That's history. That is history. And I think you are a part of that history, and that's something that should be heard on the air.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, what he said to the line producer was, "She's pretty. I hope she can act."
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
And with that, I will put the music on, and I'll see you all on the radio in 2024, everyone. Thank you, Franz. I'll see you in the webinar in a few minutes. Thank you, everyone.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby. Hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, 'cause they don't know how to love you far away. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night. Bless my soul, I love you. Just take this heart away. I'm